Welcome to our weekly ESSA strategy call. This week, we're taking on an issue that's of utmost importance to Gateway City leaders, identifying student growth. And with us, we have Andrew Rice. Let's get started.
Andrew, could you give us some background on, what do you think is the best approach to isolating school value added when we're talking about inclusive urban school districts? And are there any states that have gotten there that have already implemented that type of a model?
Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to give you a solid answer here, because best is an interesting word that implies that there's a certain set of policy goals. So instead, I'll sort of edit the question and say the one that's most accurate at measuring growth in sort of a abstract sense. So there's been years and years of research on how do you use test scores to think about the impact of schools on test scores. And I want to be very careful about speech here, because that doesn't necessarily mean effective schools or ineffective schools. It just means we can measure the impact on test scores. And there's a whole other debate, of course, we all know about whether or not test scores are the things we should be looking at. But if we're interested in knowledge and changes in knowledge of kids, right now the best we have are tests. And then the best we have as far as measuring the impact on that are these growth or value-added models. And what you see there is there's three big flavors of this. There's a student growth percentile, sort of brand name student growth percentile that a lot of states use. There's something called a value-added model, which is a similar model that has a little bit of a different flavor to it. And then there's something that you might see out there, although it's not implemented in a ton of places, called PRR. For the purposes of this, let's just say PRR and SGP are similar, and value added is slightly different. And the difference is in, was the model designed to think about students directly, or is the model designed to think about impact of a school system on the students? And so SGP models and PRR models are designed to estimate the growth of students rather than the impact of schools, whereas value-added models would be used to measure the impact of schools on those kids. And a good value-added model can get pretty close to start to measure the impact of the school on the kids, trying to get rid of all the impacts of, as many as we can, of the context that those kids are in. So in the case that you guys are talking about here, where you have potentially a lot of very inclusive urban schools, you want to be very careful that you're not creating growth measures that accidentally sort of pin on the school some of the societal issues at large in those urban districts. And so there's been a lot of talk about this. Sometimes you may want to include things in a model like free reduced lunch or a special education status or English language learners, and depending on your policy needs, you may or may not do that. The most scientifically accurate one, though, is one that uses as much information as possible. And so if we're looking at scientific accuracy, we want to include as much data as we can, and then go from there as far as policy goes.
Any sense, Massachusetts does use the SGP model, and we say that we're using it to isolate school value added. Any sense of why we made that policy decision in Massachusetts, and why states often use the SGP model?
There's two major reasons that I think people use SGP. And by the way, SGP is widely used. I think it's been investigated by academic circles in a much more recent term. So maybe in the past 3 to 5 years, we've started looking at SGPs. I want to be very clear. SGPs and value-added, from a statistical perspective, are very, very close to each other. And the reality of it is that instead, the differences come in how you report things. So in an SGP, you're going to report on a student-by-student level. And on a student-by-student level, those things are fairly noisy. So if I look at a student who has a 75 SGP, I, as a scientist, I'm not sure if, between 50 and 100, that kid could be anywhere between 50 and 100, say. Whereas if I look at a school that has a median SGP of, say, 75, I'm pretty sure that the kids on median are in the 75 range. As far as why states did it, I think there was a lot of, you know, back with the waivers and even before that with Race to the Top, this was a relatively easy first step in going on growth modeling. There's a very nice package by Damian Bettenbetter in R that lets you do this at a relatively low cost. And it's really useful, or it can be really useful, to look at student growth. And it's a heck of a lot better than, say, thinking about rating schools based off their proficiency levels, because that is, you know, very, very correlated with the environment the kids are in rather than, like, the societal and urban environment the kids are in rather than the school performance. So I don't know why various states chose that, but I think it it boils down a little bit to ease of use, and a lot of other states have decided that that's a good, it's a high-quality model that can be used for certain things.
And is there a different approach to measuring growth that, you know, we should think about when we're looking at a elementary school versus a middle school or high school? You know, relating to the different testing and the different grade spans and other kind of considerations.
Yes. So an elementary school and middle school are very similar, except for when you start getting into like eighth grade, sometimes you start seeing some algebra class patterns and things like that that you may want to consider. But for the most part, elementary and middle school can be modeled similarly, with one exception, which is that you never want to compare your elementary school growth ratings to your middle school growth ratings. Those will have different characteristics. And so, for instance, if an elementary school that has a 66 growth rating, say an SGP, will not be the same as a middle school that has a 66. And there's a lot of details to that, which you know, we could go into details on, but just take it at that. You shouldn't try and create a report that says that 66, that middle schools and elementaries can be compared. And I've found that most states have figured that out just in general. You know, elementary school attendance is different than middle school and high school, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all the way down the line. So that's usually not a big deal. whereas high school, on the other hand, depending on the context, again, we have to go back to the measurement, right? Like, if our goal is to measure changes in student knowledge growth or growth in student knowledge, then the very first thing we need to know is, can we even get a sense of what their knowledge level is? And that requires an assessment of some sort. And in high school, a lot of times there aren't assessments, or if they are, they have all sorts of interesting course patterns. So you may take algebra before geometry, you may take geometry before algebra, that sort of thing. At that point, you need to get, if you really want to be serious about modeling those things, and we've worked with several states on this, it's not straightforward how you do that, and you have to be very careful about that you're monitoring how the course patterns are going. But you can get good growth measures there. It's just a little bit more nuanced.
In an elementary school, how big is it when you don't have a test score until third grade? So students have been in that academic environment for a long time growing.
It's the size of the problem depends on your policy goal. So if your goal is to rate a K-6 versus other K-6s, for instance, I don't know if that's a common configuration in Massachusetts, but you know, you can certainly do that. You can say, you know, third grade through sixth grade growth is some rating, but you have to realize that if we compare those between the K-6s, that's all we're comparing. We're comparing the growth from 3 to 6 in those schools. And as a policy question, you have to ask yourself, well, how do I want to measure growth or other types of things in K-2 or K-3, depending on what your assessment situation is. And frankly, I guess it really just boils down to, it's not a modeling question at that point. It's just being very careful with your policy, you know, your report cards or your rating systems or things like that.
Okay. And, you know, the last question I'll put out and then I'll open it up is, you know, beyond our tested subjects, our math and English, and what else would it be appropriate to use a growth model to try and control for non-school factors?
Yeah, I think this is a very interesting area of policy research. So there's two ways to interpret this, and one is, well, what do you do when you want a growth measure for other subjects? So say, for instance, high school where we don't have assessments. And there you have to think about measuring student knowledge. And, you know, we've we had a grant with the Gates Foundation to think about how can we generate district-led, teacher-led teacher assessments that they all sort of buy into, and then how can we do sort of student learning objectives or growth measures off of that. The fact of the matter is, if you want to do a growth model, you're going to need to have some sort of measurement of knowledge. And so that's the first thing that you have to deal with. And there's this whole thing out there that you may have heard of that around student learning objectives, where a teacher might write down a student learning objective for their classroom. So teacher one says, I want John Smith to make sure they know fractions, and I want Sally to make sure she gets multiplication, something like that. We've found through our research, and others have found through their research, that these lend to very poor measurement. And at the school level in particular, it can lead to wildly different school ratings depending on how the group has set their goals. So that's something to think about. Another way to interpret that question is, can you use growth models to control for other things in other metrics? So for instance, attendance rates or graduation rates or other things like that which are going into SEL if you're interested in that. And there I think we're finding that there are methods to do that. So for instance, we're working with some of the leading researchers, Marty West and Susanna Loeb from Harvard and Stanford, to think about socio-emotional learning growth measures and impacts that schools have on those. We've run models on school impacts on attendance. And the thing is that's important to realize about growth models in general is that what they're trying to do is make it fair for everyone, as fair as they can. So urban districts are going to have worse attendance rates. They're going to have worse graduation rates. That is not necessarily the fault of the school system alone. And in fact, we don't want to take that, you know, responsibility away from our school systems, but we need to make sure that we're creating fair systems if this is indeed an accountability system. And so there are models to do that. They're quite interesting, and I think they are perfectly within the purview of the way that we interpret the ESSA situation.
And are there any states that are currently doing that or moving in that direction?
And people are thinking about it. You know, I think the hope with ESSA was that there would be more experimentation on different things. I think the reality is that because of the timelines, because of various different political influences that we could discuss forever, I guess, people are sort of going as fast as they can and doing a little bit of seeing what other states are doing, so they're kind of coalescing. But for sure, we're seeing states like California look at socio-emotional learning, culture climate type things. We're seeing states like Delaware and we're working, Virginia is doing a lot of experimentation on some new modeling to try and figure some stuff out. But I wouldn't say I'd see any implementations yet, but people are thinking about those experimentations.
Great. All right. Well, that does it for my set of questions. I'll open it up now. If people have thoughts they came to the call with and want to put out there for Andrew, I know that was a lot for him to cover in 10 minutes. So I'm sure there's probably some thoughts folks have.
And by the way, I don't have to jump off in 3 minutes, so I can stay as long as you need me to stay. Well, not as long, but.
All right. Actually, I just got one here. You know, the question came over email about using the a value-added model. Does that imply that you're getting into using race as a measure, and is that problematic?
So, is it problematic? It can definitely be problematic, depending on how your policy are structured and depending on how you interpret such a thing. So value-added measure may or may not include racial or cultural demographics, and you can make those choices as a system. I will say a lot of times when you add in racial or say gender characteristics into a value-added model, as long as you have good assessment data and as long as you have good data on ELL and special education and things like that, typically it doesn't have much impact. However, if you were to add them in, it does add a little bit of impact as a proxy for socioeconomic status. And so at that point, you say, okay, I've got a slightly better model, but I might have an issue where I've got this this demographic in my model that I don't actually want to have my model adjusted for things that really don't matter for learning. And frankly, you know, race and stuff like that just doesn't matter for learning. It's really just a proxy for socioeconomic status. Kind of an unfortunate situation that we find ourselves in this country. But I would say that then it goes to communication. If you figure out that, you know, that has a big impact in your particular area, and in some states it has a big impact, in some states it doesn't, then you need to make sure that the communication is right. And what I mean by that is it's not about setting different expectations for different races, because that's not what we're talking about. We expect that all students learn and all students become proficient. I think we all sort of want that to happen. But it is a recognition that if the model is different, there's something going on there such that we want to make sure that the goals for schools in an accountability system are reasonable. So for instance, if you don't use enough data and it sets up a really, you know, a school in a really low SES area for failure, then all you're going to generate at that school is a bunch of turnover at the leadership level and a bunch of turnover at the teacher level, because they're always being told they're failing, kind of like back in NCLB when it was all about proficiency rates. And so we just want to be very careful about that. We want to say there are the expectations for kids are that everyone gets to proficiency or above or college or whatever it is our expectations are. But the model is trying to create a fair system so that we can operate on a long-term view rather than a short-term view.
Okay. And you know, just on that point of, you know, if you're in a state where there is a lot of socioeconomic segregation across schools, does it make it harder to create a statistical model if all the low-income kids are in one school and all the affluent kids are in another school? Does the math still work?
It doesn't make it harder to do, but you may have to make some different modeling choices. And so, for instance, let's take a fake situation where you've got a state where on the west side, it's all very affluent. Let's just say that we've got all very affluent African Americans on the west side of the state, and we've got all very poor non-African Americans on the east side. Well, if that were to happen, then you may have to give up a comparison between those two sides of the state. And you would have to understand that at the policy level, that the statistics may not work out such that you could say that the best school on the east side is better or worse than the best school on the west side. But for the most part, we don't see that. We see some mixing, you know, even if it's minimal. And in those cases, we can certainly help understand the effectiveness of schools on, you know, knowledge, you know, on changing knowledge on tests.
Okay, great. Anybody else want to put a message in the chat or just throw one out there for Andrew while we have him?
What people are thinking, I do want to say, and I say this to everyone I talk to about this, these models are not flawless. And anyone that tells you they are is lying. But they are significantly better at uncovering the impacts of schools on tests than, say, just proficiency rates. Proficiency rates are almost all about the neighborhood. I said this already, but I just want to reiterate. With all the flaws that you may have heard about or read about growth models, you're getting a significant more information coming out of growth models. And then at that point, it's a question of how is the policy used around that. So I just want everyone to always, if they can, believe me on that and take that into account when they're thinking about these models.
That's really helpful, Andrew. I think in thinking about, you've talked about sort of this kind of trajectory we've been on of just implementing first generation models and then ESSA coming into play and thinking about what opportunities lie in the future. Do you have any kind of advice for advocates from urban school districts about, you know, what gains they should expect to see, or what kinds of issues they should press their state departments to keep working on and get better at?
Yes. My advice would be growth model. When we first started working on growth models, when the field did 15 years ago or whatnot, it was all about equity, equity of accountability systems. So can we make it so that that accountability systems are fair, so that everyone has an equal chance to show that they're good or not show that they're good? And as the field has kept going on the academic side, it's very obvious that the more complex models that include more data are more fair. And I mean, I could claim they're more right, although I won't get into that argument, but at least we can say they're more fair. And that especially is more fair than NCLB. And that is especially relevant for urban areas where over the last, whatever, 10 years, 15 years, we've been saying that the urban schools are failing. I know for a fact that that's not true. I've seen it in all sorts of data that urban schools in many cases have higher performing growth than in areas that are sort of wealthier with more resources. I couldn't tell you why. I have some hypotheses, but certainly if you're told you're the worst and you're working really hard, you want to see the results of that, and you can't see it if you don't measure it well. And so I would continue to advocate for the best data you can get. And then on the policy side, you know, I think there's all these questions about ratings and stuff like that, report cards. I would just advocate that all schools, urban or not, should be held accountable. If we're going to have accountability systems, should be held accountable for the things they can control. And the only way that we can understand those systems is if we can measure that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, we just have a comment here from Ben who I think kind of just, I don't know if everybody can probably see this, reinforces the point that Rob just made. I mean, the law is forcing us to level schools. And I think his question is, how could growth modeling help us figure out which schools are doing better if they're not demonstrating comparative growth?
Maybe I'm missing. Can you say that again? I don't know if I heard it.
I'm trying. It's a long question, so I'm just trying to get a handle on the whole thing.
Sure.
I don't know, Ben, if you just want to ask it out. I don't know. He might be on the.
Can you hear me?
Oh, yep. There you are.
The statement part was that we have a level system in Massachusetts that maintains a percentage of our schools always at the lowest percentile,
uh-huh.
as many states do.
Sure.
And some of the schools, as you just mentioned, are urban schools that have made significant growth over time or had significant impact through various implementations of, you know, improvement.
Sure.
But are not demonstrating comparative growth to other schools around the state, or they might
sure.
be isolated with like schools, but compared to themselves, many years ago they may be showing growth, but not in a when compared to the state. So how can growth modeling help with that, or proficiency and using those two functions together?
Yeah. That's a fantastic question because there's some technical stuff, right? Like you could try and figure out if the models are somehow biased or not. But let's for a second say that the model that Massachusetts is using is not biased, and it's a good model. And I know the model it's using, and you know, every model has its flaws. But you know, the way to think about these models is kind of, you know, are we having the impact that relative to other schools in similar situations to us? In an SGP case, it's relative to other schools in similar situations only on test scores. And so that's not going to take into account other SES factors like ELL or special education or free reduced lunch, that type of thing. And if the state, you know, as you're developing policies around this, it's true. I mean, I would say, and you can believe me or not on this, it's true that that school may still be in the lowest, you know, whatever, 10% of schools on impact on knowledge growth. But that it shouldn't be the case necessarily that's, you know, this is a long-term project, right? If you want to turn around a school, it may take 5-10 years to change your leadership, to change your policies, to do whatever you're doing as a superintendent. And so you just kind of want to see those schools get better. And part of the way you see that is through proficiency rates. Part of the way you see that is through changing growth ratings over time. Because frankly, the rank of a school within a state on anything, but especially on growth models, is informative, but it doesn't mean they're good or bad. It just means they sit somewhere within the state with what other schools are doing. And so you can take that knowledge for what it's worth. Now, I will say there's this whole other issue about public reporting, and you have to be very careful on growth models and public reporting because, you know, we're sitting here talking, and you guys have been immersed with this for a while now probably, and so you probably have a grasp on growth models, but the public just doesn't. And so if you have a school that's rated really low on growth models, it's not clear how the public perceives that, and it's not clear as a superintendent or as a state office how you handle that, except through profound amounts of communication. Because it is more information than the public's used to having, it's just harder to interpret.
Great. Well, Andrew, why don't we stop there, because we've already taken more of your time than I was wanting to today.
No problem.
Grateful for you to being on the call with us.